Welcome to Why So Weekend, WYSO's weekly radio magazine. I'm Jerry Kenny. On today's program, you'll hear about the latest element to WYSO's Reinvention Stories project. Nikki Dakota has all the information. Also ahead, Elizabeth Holford with Equality Ohio. She'll tell us what the Supreme Court's decision last week striking down a portion of the Defense of Marriage Act means for Ohio. And WYSO's Juliet Fromholt talks with Dayton History's Brady Kress about their latest acquisition, Hawthorne Hill. Up first, federal officials investigating last Saturday's plane crash at the Dayton Air Show say it may take up to a year before the cause of the crash can be determined. Multiple internet videos show the duo's 450 HP Stearman biplane flying low and upside down before it turned and plunged to the ground, exploding into flames before thousands of spectators. Airshow General Manager Brenda Kerfoot says the investigation will focus on three areas of possible cause.
The people, the machine, which would be the aircraft, and the environment, which would include all of the, you know, weather factors, humidity, temperature, winds, et cetera, that they're collecting, as you can imagine, probably hundreds of pieces of information, including film, pictures, et cetera, and that he does not expect to have any kind of conclusive report for at least 6 months and probably closer to a year.
An initial coroner's report says that 44-year-old wing walker Jane Wicker and the plane's pilot, 64-year-old Charlie Schwenker, died of blunt force trauma. The Federal Highway Administration's Office of Civil Rights has ordered the city of Beaver Creek to revisit its decision to deny RTA's request to add several bus stops near the mall at Fairfield Commons. WYSO's Wayne Baker reports that the FHA says Beaver Creek's decision is in violation of the Civil Rights Act.
2 years ago, RTA in Dayton wanted to add bus stops on Pentagon Boulevard near the mall at Fairfield Commons and the newly constructed Soin Medical Center. That request was unanimously denied by Beaver Creek City Council, even though the city's compliance staff had approved the RTA's proposal, citing that they met Beaver Creek's compliance standards. The Dayton-based church organization, Leaders for Equality in Action, also known as LEAD, filed a complaint about the bus stop denial in 2011. LEAD alleged that the city of Beaver Creek failed to comply with the Title VI section of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. The FHA Wednesday ruled in LEAD's favor, stating that African Americans have faced discriminatory impact as a result of the city's decision. The FHA says that the city has 90 days to comply with the ruling and the RTA can resubmit its request for the bus stops. The Ohio Department of Transportation will oversee the city's response and assist it in the process. If the city ignores the FHA's ruling, it stands to lose over $10 million in federal funding for highway construction projects over a five-year period. LEAD is planning a protest walk at noon on Saturday across the I-675 overpass on North Fairfield Road. They say the walk is to encourage the city of Beaver Creek to move quickly on the bus stop installations. For WYSO, I'm Wayne Baker reporting.
And to expand on the information in this report, Wayne Baker spoke with LEAD's attorney, Ellis Jacobs.
The complaint that we filed was with the Federal Highway Administration, so it was an administrative complaint, and the Federal Highway Administration found that Beaver Creek was in violation of Title VI of the Civil Rights Act. Title VI says that if you take federal money, and Beaver Creek's taken tens of millions of dollars of federal money over the years for their roads, then you can't discriminate. And the Highway Administration found that by barring the RTA from having bus stops on Pentagon Boulevard near the mall in Beaver Creek, they had discriminated against bus riders who are predominantly African American. The Highway Administration has told Beaver Creek that they need to rehear RTA's application for the bus stops, but this time to only apply criteria that are fair and impartial and not criteria that are a pretense for discrimination as they did previously. Rehear it. And if they won't do that, they are at risk of losing all of their federal highway money. And right now, they have about $10 million in the pipeline to Beaver Creek to help them with road projects out there.
So the RTA at this point, now they just resubmit it. And what kind of timeline are we looking at?
The Highway Administration gave Beaver Creek 90 days to act. And they said, if you don't act within those 90 days, we may take away your highway money, or we may, and or we may refer this to the Department of Justice for an investigation. The RTA has said, hey, they could set temporary bus stops up there at a moment's notice. It would take a little longer to actually build bus shelters, but they're ready to go. They want to provide this service. They know that there are a lot of jobs out there near the mall and at that new hospital, and that the people that they serve, people who ride the bus, need to be able to get to those locations.
And I think that we've spoken in the past about some of that criteria, the air-conditioned bus shelters. Can you talk about some of the criteria that was deemed sort of dicey?
Yeah, when Beaver Creek turned down RTA's application for the bus stops there, they told RTA that first they would have to meet all these elaborate and expensive requirements for having bus stops there, like their bus stops would have to be heated and air-conditioned. Well, the head of the RTA said the only bus stops he's seen like that in the world are in Dubai. Beaver Creek told the RTA that the concrete pad that the buses would stop on in the road had to be 18 inches thick. Well, that's how thick they are on a runway where airplanes are landing. The RTA has 10-inch thick concrete pads downtown where they have 1,500 buses a day. This particular bus stop would have 6 buses a day. So those sorts of requirements were clearly a pretense for just wanting to keep the buses out, wanting to keep people from being able to ride the bus from Dayton out to Beaver Creek. And that's essentially what the Federal Highway Administration told Beaver Creek, that their actions had the effect of discriminating, and they needed to stop it, or else they were running the risk of losing all of their highway money.
Well, Ellis, thank you very much for your time, and certainly appreciate it.
Sure. Thank you.
With the Supreme Court's affirmation that the federal government cannot discriminate against married couples of the same sex, those couples residing in Ohio should now be eligible for the same federal benefits and programs available to heterosexual married couples, though the state of Ohio still won't have to recognize same-sex marriages performed in other jurisdictions. Gay marriage advocates in the state are celebrating. To sort all this out, I spoke with Elizabeth Holford, Executive Director of Equality Ohio. We begin with a little bit of background on how these cases went up to the Supreme Court.
Well, we had two decisions. One is the Proposition 8 case. And in that case, in California, what was at stake was really the ability and right to get married in the state of California. And the Supreme Court basically said when the trial had occurred, people that were trying to get married actually won, and Proposition 8 was thrown out after the trial, and the state of California did not pursue it. They wanted to leave it as was, and they were willing to grant marriages again. But a group of private citizens disagreed, and they entered into the lawsuit and appealed, and the Supreme Court said, nope, we've never really allowed private parties that really can't show direct injury and don't show themselves as being, they weren't part of the state, so they weren't the actual defendants in the original suit. So the Supreme Court said, nope, you don't have standing, you can't do that. So they remanded the case, vacated the decision at the appellate court, and basically the trial court decision stands, which means in California, the most populous state in the U.S., they now again have the right for same-sex couples to marriage. So marriage equality stands again in California. And then the other case, that's the Perry case. And the other case is the Windsor case, which is the Defense of Marriage Act case. And in that case, it was a question about Section 3. And Section 3 of the DOMA statute basically says that marriage is limited to one man and one woman, and that a spouse is actually somebody, has to be somebody of the opposite sex before any benefits or rights under federal laws can go to that couple. Well, the issue at the heart of the case is, can you treat people that are legally married in their states, can you then treat them differently under a federal law that cordons some people off and treats them in a different way? And that is can be considered a violation of the Equal Protection Clause. And the Supreme Court said, yes, that is a violation of the Equal Protection Clause, and Section 3 of that statute is struck down. So how do both those cases affect Ohio? Well, I think there's some impact in terms of both emotional and really lifting us up around the Proposition 8 case, because it's always reassuring when you have the Supreme Court of your land say, these people didn't have the right to challenge this, and in fact, marriage equality then stands in Ohio. I'm sorry, in California. It does not directly, that decision does not directly impact our laws, because in Ohio we have a marriage inequality constitutional amendment, and we also have our own statewide DOMA, and they are not affected by the Perry case out of California. And the DOMA case, there's sort of a question about, well, does that then mean that all DOMA statutes and you know, across the land are then considered to be inappropriate or illegal? And the decision is not that far-reaching, from at least from my first read of it. It is a decision that is limited specifically to legally married couples, meaning in states that if you are married in a state where you can get married, then you certainly are subject to be treated the same as other married couples in that state. And really the question for Ohio then is, well, if I'm legally married in another state but then I move here, does this decision require that Ohio then recognize the marriage? And most legal experts agree that it does not require that. But then does it mean that I am still eligible as a married couple to federal benefits, and even though I'm living in Ohio? And that remains to be seen. I think that it probably means that you are entitled, just like any other married couple, where if you have a legally valid marriage, then you are entitled to Social Security benefits, to filing your federal, not state, but your federal income tax together. But again, that remains to be seen.
Okay, so I have heard some analysis that states that spousal rights will be available in states that do not necessarily support gay marriage, but you're saying that's still up in the air.
Well, my read of it is that federal, not state, benefits, but federal benefits, because it was a federal decision about federal law. That if you have a legally recognized marriage that is a legal marriage in a state where you could get married, then no matter where you move, you are still married in terms of, in the eyes of federal law.
Okay.
So I happen to agree with that analysis, but I think that that we will see how that plays out.
Okay, and do you think this sets up more confrontations between states and federal law, or does this eliminate some conflicts?
I don't think it eliminates conflict, but I don't think it sets up, our situation is for states that do not have marriage equality, our situation in Ohio is a perfect example, because I don't think it changes anything other than that it provides more, I think, more support and more public awareness. But in Ohio, we still have our work cut out to do. We need to repeal and replace that constitutional marriage inequality amendment. We still need to repeal the DOMA that we have, the statewide DOMA. And we live in a state where we don't, as a community, have any statewide legislation that protects us. So we don't have a non-discrimination statute that protects us at work, at home, in our housing, or in public accommodation situations. We don't have any enumeration in the anti-bullying law in Ohio, and it's a tragedy, because the 80% of students in Ohio that are bullied because they either are gay or people think they are. We also don't have any protection in the hate crimes legislation, and in Ohio we are one of three states which, after you undergo a transition, you cannot change your gender marker on your birth certificate. So in Ohio, we've got a pretty tall order, and yet what's really great is at Equality Ohio, we know how to do more than one thing at once.
So those are the issues that you'll be working on moving forward.
Absolutely. Marriage equality, non-discrimination, anti-bullying, all of the above that I mentioned before, but those are all right there.
Great. Elizabeth, any final comments on all of this coming out today?
Well, it's a day for celebration, absolutely a day for celebration. And then tomorrow, right back to work on all the things that will be sure to ensure that we have laws in Ohio that protect and reflect all of us fairly and equally.
Elizabeth, thanks so much for speaking with us today.
Absolutely not a problem, and thanks for calling.
Elizabeth Holford, Executive Director with Equality Ohio. You're listening to WISO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO, public radio for the Miami Valley. On Thursday, the Dayton Foundation and the Wright Family Foundation announced that ownership of Hawthorne Hill is transferring to Dayton History. WISO's Juliet Fromholt spoke with Dayton History's Brady Kress about this.
Well, yeah, real exciting. I'm sitting in our new dining room right now. The Wright Family Foundation and Dayton Foundation transferred ownership of the Hawthorne Hill, the National Historic Landmark, that is Orville Wright's home to us today. So we're very excited.
Prior to this, I know that Dayton History was involved with Hawthorne Hill. You guys were doing some of the tours there. How do you envision your role now that you are owners of the site?
It really allows us, you're correct in that we were providing the maintenance and the grounds care and the touring and the rental. I mean, it really was kind of a turnkey management agreement. But, you know, at the same time, we were still renters, not owners. And so as we operated the other, you know, six sites, you know, there are 30 buildings at Carillon, as we operated all those, we were doing what we were contracted to do. We can now look as owners at Hawthorne Hill in a different way, and that is to start to implement a lot of the furnishings and restoration plans, interior plans that have been put in place and developed over the last few years in conjunction with us and the National Park Service. So we're very excited in that we will be able to really start moving forward on those and be able to dedicate staff resources as owners of the property as opposed to dedicating resources outside of the contract for property that we didn't have a long-term stake in.
And this really comes kind of at the head of what's been a big couple of years for Dayton History with the the new developments at Carillon Park and the Museum Center. Do you guys have kind of an extended vision of how all of these different sites are going to work together with Carillon as the centerpiece?
Yeah, it really is a neat opportunity for us to build, and this is a perfect example of it, to build a network of museum properties that are interdependent on each other, and we're able to leverage the strengths of all of our staff and leverage the strengths of different properties. So Carillon is suited for a couple of things, not only for the house itself, suited well to support the house, but it also is suited well to support the political angle in that we have a close relationship that we have to monitor with the neighbors. You know, this is a museum that we're operating in the middle of a very, very exclusive neighborhood. And so we want to make sure that we're very respectful to the neighbors as we share this National Historic Landmark with guests from all over the state, the country, and the world. And so Carillon allows us to do that. I don't think a group that was solely based at Hawthorne Hill would be able to do it as well. Carillon allows us to have parking at Carillon, all of the introductions to the history of the property at Carillon, all of the guest services reside there. So restrooms, gift shop, restaurant, all of those aspects can remain at Carillon Park, and then we can shuttle people up to the house. It's not unlike Monticello in that case. In that scenario, you wouldn't want to build a visitor center where it would disrupt the mountaintop view that Thomas Jefferson built at Monticello. So they have all of those support functions down the hill, down the mountain, and they shuttle people up to the house. So we look at this in the same way.
Well, and in talking about sort of the finance end of things, I understand that in addition to the transfer, there was also a $1 million gift that's going to establish a fund to help preserve and maintain Hawthorne Hill.
That was key to our decision, and so you are correct. Yes, we're very excited. There were a number of champions that stepped forward in the community. Again, private dollars, private donors that established this $1 million fund. We hope to continue adding to that fund, and it's going to provide revenue. You know, it's going to throw off enough money to help us with the fixed costs of the house, so the utility piece, and maintenance, basic maintenance and care, And hopefully we will be efficient enough with that that we can start to create a reserve account that will help us when it comes time to repaint the home, to put a new roof in, to upgrade the HVAC systems, or to do the restoration that needs to be done here. So,
should visitors expect any immediate changes in, you know, the types of tours and experiences that are being offered now that the transfer has happened, or will that be something that's going to be evolving over time and as restoration starts and things like that?
Yeah, what will be exciting for visitors to see and to watch this evolve is that we will be starting over the next couple months, starting to repatriate a lot of the original furnishings back into the home. Many of the furnishings, obviously, this had been used for half a century as a guest house for the NCR Corporation, and so a lot of the furnishings that are in the house currently were part of that use. And the original furnishings were put into storage or were put on display in other facilities to other organizations, which became part of Dayton history over the last few years. And so we're going to be careful about it, work forward cautiously, but we're going to start to bring those original furnishings back into the home where people can start to see the house as Orville left it in 1948 when he last locked the doors. And I think that's going to be very exciting to really get a sense of how this great inventor lived and entertained very important guests, whether it was Edison or Ford or Charles Lindbergh, President Taft, all those folks that visited him while he was here.
Thank you so much for taking the time to chat with me.
Yeah, thank you.
WISO's Juliet Fromholt speaking with Brady Kress of Dayton History. This week, filmmaker Steve Bognar and Eva Buttacavoli with the Dayton Visual Arts Center stopped by the WISO studios to talk with Nikki Dakota about another element to reinvention stories.
Starting over, reinvention, a theme that presents itself many times here in the Miami Valley and beyond. But it's on that note that it's a pleasure to welcome to the studio today the participants in a very cool event getting underway this weekend at the Dayton Art Institute called Reinvention Portraits. Documentarian, reinvention story spearhead, and a friend of WISO, Steve Bognar, welcome and thanks for coming today.
Thank you, Nikki. It's great to be here.
It's a big weekend, and it also involves Reinvention Stories, Dayton Art Institute, and our next guest, the Dayton Visual Arts Center. She's Eva Buttacavoli, and welcome, Eva.
Thank you, Nikki.
There are several vectors that are coming together on Sunday in our Gem City. Give us a little bit of what is sort of focused there this weekend.
Well, there are all these vectors coming together. We're talking DVAC and reinvention stories. Steve Bognar, Julia Reichart, and the Reinvention Collaborative, we've all put together an exhibition that will be open to the public on Sunday at DAI, and it's called Reinvention Portraits.
Not just are these vectors all coming together, but this is also a new and a reinvented and a starting over for this collaboration with DAI and DVAC.
Sure. DAI's come to us. We've been working on it for a couple of years now. Different aspects of highlighting local artists, local projects at DAI. Because, you know, not only does DAI have traveling exhibitions and their wonderful collection, but there's also a great opportunity to show off our local art scene in that beautiful building. So DVAC's worked with DAI to do a couple of small exhibitions in the Leo Bistro and the cafe. But this is going to be the first one that's in Gallery 209, a soul gallery dedicated to the art of this amazing local story. So we've managed to work with the reinvention team, and Steve will tell you about the website and everything going on, but we're highlighting 15 portraits from the reinvention project in Gallery 209 at DAI as the kickoff of this collaboration.
It's such an honor to be doing this, too. You know, we're thrilled that the Dayton Art Institute and DVAC are teaming up to present these photos and that Eva was willing to take on the curatorial job. She went through, you know, tons of photos that we took last year.
Best part of my job.
And, and she picked these portraits. You know, as you know, Nikki, Reinvention Stories has been a series on WYSO since January, and it's been an amazing series. We're so incredibly proud of the series. But what people have not seen are so many of the photos that were taken last year, thousands of pictures. And so this is a great opportunity to sort of showcase these beautiful photos. They're huge. They're like 3 foot.
They are huge.
Bigger than life. You will walk into the room and they will envelop you. The community envelops you. These faces, these people, the people that we live with on their porches in their front yard, they just envelop you in this room. You're embraced by the community.
They really are some stunning, stunning sort of pictures of some of the faces that that make up this place where we live.
And, you know, the other photographers are Liz Cameron, Emily Evans, Megan Haig, Chandra Jones, and Kyle Wilkinson, and WYSO's news director, Emily McCord.
That's right.
And we're all thrilled to be in the show and to have work showing at the Dayton Art Institute and with DVAC. It's just a great honor. And the show will run until September 29th, so it'll be up all the rest of the summer. On July 31st, we're going to have a reception and a gallery talk open to the public. We hope everyone will come. If you haven't seen the show by then, it'll just come on down. It'll be fun. A bunch of the people who took the pictures and are in the pictures will be there. And
it'll
be a really good time. July 31st, probably 6 to 8 p.m.
Will there be more information about this at reinventionstories.org?
Actually, yes. And also at WISO.org and at DVAC and at DAI. The word will get out heavily.
Yeah. So come on out. Commune with the people that live in your city, this amazing gem city that is ours, that is always in the process of reinventing and being reborn and redirected and sort of revel in these stories and these images with this great collaboration with WYSO, Reinvention Stories, DVAC, and DAI. Thanks, guys, for sharing with us today.
Can I mention one other thing? You know, While we're so proud of the photos, there's also going to be a video installation piece, and there's going to be a computer in the gallery where people can go to reinventionstories.org and experience the sort of interactive documentary live right there. You put on headphones and you kind of drift in there in the art museum at the DAI. The wall of video, it's not a wall, but it's a large screen monitor is going to be showcasing kind of a crazy thing we did last summer where we got these little GoPro wide-angle cameras and we mounted them to our car. We put 3 of them on our car.
So it ends up being a triptych, or what you think of as like a three-panel.
But it's so much more.
It's like a split-screen triptych, and we just drove all over town, left, right, up, down, north, east, west, and gathered images. And so this is like a collage of our city. We were really trying to see our city in a new way.
It is really something to experience this.
Wait till you see that. It's just when I first saw it, my mouth just dropped open, and I literally said, I have never seen anything like this before. It is such a beautiful composite. It affects you physically. You're going to be rolling through the streets of Dayton.
So a lot of things there together. And also, I think it's a great honor for WYSO and Reinvention to be involved in this first ever collaboration with Dayton Art Institute and DVAC, correct?
Yes, yes.
And this will be
three of the treasures of Dayton, WYSO, DVAC, and the Dayton Art Institute all together. It's a great thing. And so, I do want to mention that, you know, all this happened because we got a lot of support. We had national support, but we also had local support from the Dayton Foundation, the Yellow Springs Community Foundation, and Wright State's Celia program. And all those folks stepped up to the plate to make all this happen, and it's been hugely helpful.
Stories are for sharing. We're made better when we do. I just am convinced of it. And songs are stories, books are stories, and movies are stories, and photographs are stories. Come and share yours and share in your neighbor's stories. And that is this Sunday, opening at regular museum hours, which is noon until 5 p.m. this Sunday, June 30, at the Dayton Art Institute. And then mark your calendar for a very special reception and gallery talk. That's Wednesday, July 31st from 6 until 8 p.m. You'll be there, Steve. Julia Reichert will be there.
Eva will be there.
And you'll be there. And a very nice opportunity to come and commune, gather with your friends.
Yeah.
Thanks, guys. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Nikki.
Keep us posted.
That's it for this edition of WISO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO. Yellow Springs, Dayton, Springfield, and online at WYSO.org. A broadcast service of Antioch University for the Miami Valley. I'm Jerry Kenney. Coming up next on WYSO, The Book Nook.